This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 27th of December 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Montclair.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Samaritz with me, Tyler Brulé, and Sophie Grove. Coming up over the next 60 minutes,
we explore Swiss design with local Samaritz architect Hans-Jörg Ruch.
Plus, we cast our net to other city realms and discover the Alpine competition developing in Turkey.
We are a group of boutique hotels. We opened our skiing resort almost 5 years ago in Kartalkaya.
And our reporter Gillian Dubias meets the movers and shakers in the Engadine's contemporary art community and finds it full of life despite the wintry snow, especially tonight.
Because it's a historical space, no? it has a very special character. And I think that today, nowadays, too often we tend to see art just in art fairs, in kind of on dull spaces, on just temporary walls.
And our man in Denmark, Michael Booth, rewinds the clock to summer and makes a trip to Lapland to find Santa still hard at work despite the clement weather.
So people come here, even the height of summer, even if they're not mentally unbalanced like me and my son here, Asker, ordinary people come up here during the summertime to meet Father Christmas.
Yeah, surprisingly many people come over to see the Santa Claus.
Lots more coming up over the next hour here on Midori House, live from Samaritz on Monocle 24. And welcome to a very, very snowy Samaritz. We talked a little bit about those odd flakes right now, but we have a table absolutely covered in snow. I'm looking out at our production team. Our Jack Phillips has an improvised umbrella come hat, and everyone is very much bundled up here.
It is quite astonishing, and it's funny because at lunchtime we had a wonderful little crowd of locals all listening to the show. Some people are looking over at us like we might be insane.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, who are these two people camped out in the middle of the square in Samaritz? And I'm hoping that our newsman back in London, Jonathan Wheatley, is there with the headlines. Hello, Jonathan.
Thank you very much, Tyler. India has today experienced another spate of anti-rape rallies in various parts of the country. The protesters voiced their anger at both the federal and state administration for not initiating remedial measures after the recent brutal gang rape of a 23-year-old paramedical student in New Delhi. Scores of young students have taken to the streets of the capital, but were stopped by police. Sohini Ghosh is one of those students from Kolkata.
It's completely sad on the part of the government, especially since they're doing nothing about the innumerable rape incidents which are happening around us. And the crass comments that are being passed, especially by family members from respected MLAs, and they themselves being representatives of political parties, it's unacceptable and we're completely infuriated.
France has said today that it would only protect French nationals in the Central African Republic after the President François Bozizé appealed to Paris and Washington for help to push back rebels. Rebels said they had temporarily halted their advance 45 miles from Bangui to allow talks to take place. Heavy snow and high winds have caused traffic jams in the northern part of the United States, bringing chaos to motorways in many states there. Gary Jones, a traffic rescue worker from Indiana, said that many interstate highways were closed and 6 vehicles collided with each other in a traffic accident.
The interstate shut down in a couple different spots due to accidents and slide-offs. There was, a couple tractors and trailers and about 6 cars involved in just one accident. So there's quite a bit of chaos today. There's so many companies up here pulling cars out right and left. I bet they probably pull 15, 20 cars an hour. There's probably been more than that just in town alone.
Staying in the States, and the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, has today criticized Republicans in Congress for refusing to go along with any tax increases as part of a U.S. fiscal cliff remedy. He urged House of Representatives Speaker John Boehner, the top Republican in Congress, to pass a Democratic-backed bill extending low-income tax rates for all Americans, except those with net household incomes above $250,000 a year.
Everyone knows, including the Speaker of the House of Representatives today, that if they had brought up a Senate-passed bill that would give relief to everyone making less than $250,000 a year, it would pass overwhelmingly. Every Democrat would vote for it, and Republicans would vote for it. But the Speaker, he says, no, we can't do that. It has to be a majority of the majority. So they've done nothing.
And finally, here in the UK, an Englishman who suffered a stroke has baffled doctors after he woke up speaking fluent Welsh. Alan Morgan, who's 81, was evacuated to Wales during the Second World War, but left 70 years ago. During his time there, he was surrounded by Welsh speakers, but never learnt the language himself. He left the country aged 10 and lived all his life in England and recently suffered that severe stroke. But when Mr. Morgan regained consciousness 3 weeks later, doctors discovered he was speaking Welsh and could not remember any English. It's thought that the Welsh Mr. Morgan heard as a boy had sunk in without him knowing and was unlocked after he suffered that stroke. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. Sophie, there's always a bit of a Welsh mafia number going on. I'm not sure whether it's the newsreader, Mr. Jonathan Wheatley, who of course hails from Wales, or our producer this evening, Alla John, who's responsible for that piece.
I know. I think I might put the blame back in London for that one. But yeah. At least there's hope for us non-linguists.
No, well, I was going to say, you know, you might wake up tomorrow morning speaking Romansh. if we stick with this jolly beverage before us. It's just 3:06 if you're listening in Tokyo, 20:06 in Helsinki. It's 19:06 here in Samaritz, and it is gone 6 minutes past 10 on the U.S. West Coast. You're listening to Midori House. We're live in Samaritz. We're back in a moment.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 podcast, yeah.
Monocle 24 in your episode.
This is Monocle 24.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And you are back in Samaritz live with me, Tyler Brule, and Sophie Grove on this very special edition of Midori House, which is sort of Hauser House tonight because we are sitting in front of Hauser Hotel right on the main roundabout in the center of Samaritz for this very special edition that we're running all week, both the briefing and Midori House. So we'll be coming, we were live last night, this morning, we'll be here tomorrow as well, special edition of the review, and then of course New Year's Eve, and we'll also be here New Year's Day.
It's quite a program to look forward to. It's a fascinating place. I've been really tramping around Samaritz today, looking at pretty much every culinary secret there is to find.
But and then some. You got a bit of an archy tour and everything else that would happen architecturally in between. No?
I've been to the Cresta Run Clubhouse, which is so elite and exclusive on many levels. There are big signs everywhere saying "No women." Unless you're accompanied by a gentleman, which I was, the deputy secretary, who's a submariner and navy man, and he's just fantastic, actually, fearless, as you have to be for the quest to run.
Did you bump into your friend Rob Sachs, our guest from yesterday evening?
We saw his incredible house, which is quite something. It's Bauer House, former pavilion for the Olympics in 1928, which he restored beautifully, it has to be said. And we had a look at that. The Cresta Clubhouse is beautiful. It's an international style building as well. We'll be talking more about architecture later, but there's incredible wealth of architecture here in Samaritz, including the very crooked church tower that I saw.
Yeah, which looks like it could go over at any moment. As you mentioned, we've got our Ivan Carvalho, who's here on the briefing earlier today, talking about everything from Italian politics to the architectural and design merits of a Romansh radio down in Kur. But he's also interviewed Hans-Jörg Ruch for Alpino, for our special newspaper edition that's out. And Mr. Ruch is going to join us a little later with Ivan. Also, we're going to be talking contemporary art up in the Engadine. And we're going to be jumping over to Turkey as well. We'll be doing that in a moment. And then also our Michael Booth, he's our correspondent in Copenhagen. He paid a visit to Santa. So we're keeping it a little bit seasonal, but also upcoming over the next few days as well. It's going to be a bit of a revolving door of presenters. I believe that Marcus Hippie, who is one of our producers and presenters as well, he should be on the Ray to Chabon on his way up here right now, hoping to join us for dinner this evening. He'll be co-anchoring, and then I think, I know, in fact, our editor Andrew Chuck is also going to be here as well.
I know, it's going to be an absolutely great party once they all arrive.
Well, I think it's going to be a complete wrestle for the mic, because I actually don't want to move. I quite like my perch here at the end of this table. So we don't even need guests. We can just have four presenters and maybe play the odd package.
We have found quite a good way of warming up, which happens to be these amazing ginger concoctions that Hauser keeps on bringing out. Amazing. Well, and now Glühwein.
Yeah, I was going to say, your ginger concoction turned into Glühwein, and and I'm about ready for another one as well.
Well, to kick off tonight's show, we head first to Turkey to explore its growing alpine tourist destinations.
Sebnem Uyar, owner and founder of Golden Key Hotel in Katarkia, Bursa, one of Turkey's select skiing destinations, stopped by Midori House Studios in London to talk about her very own skiing resort, Turkey's growing skiing industry, and ways to improve it. She spoke to our Alexander de Kramer.
Tell us about a bit of how the industry is in Kartalkaya, because it's very boutique and small at
yes.
the moment.
Yeah. Actually, we are a group of boutique hotels, as you know. We have two hotels. We are operating in the south of Turkey, in the Aegean area. So we are almost since 14 years in the hotelery business. And we decided to have a skiing resort also because of our staff. Because our staff is so good. We didn't want them, on the 6 months job. So we want them all year around. Also, that's a big plus for us because then the quality of the service at the hotel is great when you are running, the hotel with the same staff. We opened our skiing resort almost 5 years ago in Kartalkaya. At that time, there were only three bigger hotels, like more than 200 rooms. Okay. We have only 43 rooms, so it is really a boutique hotel.
Compared to the Aegean, how is the skiing industry doing? Because Aegean is known to be more of a surfing, beach, summer.
That's
And
true.
That's what Turkey is known for.
Yes, sun, sea and...
Exactly. But true. Do you think there could be a shift towards the skiing industry?
It is, of course, growing in Turkey, but you cannot compare with the sun and, because it is much bigger in the south. The more summer resort is bigger than it. But it is a growing market, I believe, and it will be better in the coming years. If they begin making some investments, it will look great. Even Kartalkaya, it is a very nice valley. But it doesn't become like a skiing village with all activities, like with food and beverage, with different type of hotels and all the like boutiques. There is a big opportunity for that. I can tell. But it is not like that right now. But I'm sure in the coming, future, it will grow.
What does it lack or what does it need to reach to that level?
Actually, it is a little bit with the government also. It depends because, it needs a big, huge investment, big budgets. So the local authority has a planning with the government and make, for example, right now there are two big slopes in Kartalkaya. We don't have any slopes as a hotel. Mm-hmm. But because the government, the Ministry of Tourism rented the hotel and the hotel area and the slopes to the people years ago. And they invested by themselves, so they are running it by themselves. But of course, it is not very good. They are taking care of the slopes and everything, but it needs to be invested and get more modernized and all that. But if the local authority, like Bolu, is the town Kartalkaya belongs to, when they decide to make the place Bolu and Kartalkaya more hotspot, more popular, they have to work with the government and make some planning, I think.
How do you set yourself apart from the other hotels in the region?
Like I mentioned, we are in the hospitality sector, a couple of years, so we know the service, a good service, and our aim is to fulfill all the expectations of the guests. So that's why we have small details we have, and also the architecture of the building, of the hotel, and the decoration is very unique. We are looking different from the other hotels.
Who designed the hotel? Is it a local architect or was it
a very young group of three architects. One of them was French, one of them was Italian, and one of them was Turkish. Actually, after the first year, because it is a prefabricated building, you know, because it is hard to build in that, like 2,200 meters high is the mountain. We like to build it quickly, so it got very modern look, and we got an award.
Who's your clientele, and what do you offer other than the hotels around you?
People are coming for winter sports, of course, but all the guests who comes, you know, to find themselves in a cozy atmosphere, in a stylish atmosphere, and with really good service, they choose us, I believe.
What are some tips you'd like to give us about, like, the surviving in the Kartalkaya region?
The hotel physically is very beautiful with all these 43 rooms, and we have a variety of different rooms. Like, we have 100 square meter rooms for families. We have romantic suites with jacuzzis inside. Really different. All rooms are different. So if you put this hotel, like, you know, to Aspen, Deer Valley, or wherever in the world, like in Europe, in St. Moritz or in Courchevel or some other hot spots, skiing resorts, it will feel, because physically and with the service, maybe it is compared to some hotels in that regions, we are much better. But of course, like I mentioned at the beginning, it needs more infrastructure, the places, you know.
Kartalkaya in general.
Yes, Kartalkaya in generally.
Skiing.
Yes, I believe in it. I mean, there is a really big potential for that. You can do it easily, but it needs the government and the local authorities' investments.
And that was Sebnem Uyar speaking to our Alexander de Cromer in London about the burgeoning Turkish hospitality industry. You're listening to Midori House. We're coming to you live from St. Moritz this evening. We're on the terrace of the Hotel Hauser in the center of the village. And I'm Tyler Brule, and Sophie Grove is right beside me.
We'll be back to hear from local architect Hans-Jörg Ruch. Hans' architecture prevails throughout the Engadine and has featured in our winter newspaper Alpino under the deft exploration of our correspondent Ivan Carvalho. Both Hans and Ivan will join us shortly.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St. Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
Before you set off on your travels this winter season, don't forget to pick up your issue of Monocle's winter newspaper, Monocle Alpino. We get cold weather combat training from Japan's elite snow patrols. We look at how Iceland has picked itself up and dusted itself off after a nasty wipeout. And we find the comfortable alpine retreats that will have you packing your bags and heading for the hills. Plus, we look at winter warming fashion ideas with all of the trimmings, including Bavarian lederhosen. That's all in the current issue of Monocle Alpino. Prost und zum Wohl!
You're listening to Midori House live from the bustling square of the Hotel Hauser Terrace in Switzerland's St. Moritz.
It's just a 1918 here in St. Moritz. It's just 1318 on the North American East Coast. Well, when it comes to the built environment in St. Moritz and surrounding area, there's architecture to suit all tastes. Centuries-old traditional Engadine homes sit next to new builds, catering to, of course, the ever-growing tourism market.
Hans-Jörg Ruch, renowned architect based in St. Moritz, has focused his career on marrying the new and the old, preserving the region's traditional architecture, while also inserting modern elements into them. He's noted for converting local farmhouses into vacation homes.
And Hans joins us now here in our little makeshift studio in the center of St. Moritz. He's also, we're sort of sandwiched between Sophie and Hans. We have our Ivan Carvalho, our Milan correspondent. Also, our reporter also did the piece that Sophie mentioned in our current Monocle Alpino. Hans, welcome. Maybe you should be welcoming us to your town. I'm not quite sure.
Well, very well welcome. Yeah. Okay.
A little bit earlier today, we were talking about just the influence that, that the geography has? Because I think a lot of time when people think about alpine valleys, if they haven't been to the Engadine, it's not one of these deep, steep valleys like Verbier or somewhere else. You have a, you know, it is a very wide plain in between. So much so that you could actually land planes. There's even an airport in it. It's so wide. How does the architecture, or I should say, how does the environment of the region really affect your work?
I think the landscape of the Engadine is the absolutely highest quality we have. And I tend to compare this landscape space with a bowl, with irregular edges, the mountains. And in this bowl, there is some water left, the lakes. In this bowl, everybody feels protected. In this bowl is the whole energy of the people who have spent part of their life here. The philosophers like Nietzsche, the writers like Hesse, the painters like Hodler. And this energy is just in this bowl. And also the weather changes in this bowl are incredible. We just, from yesterday to today, the change of the weather, everything is happening in this bowl. And the image of this bowl is in the mind of all the people who are in here. We could make a test. You could close your eyes, ask yourself where you are, and you see this image of the bowl of the Engadine. That's an incredible quality. And the spaces we architects are doing are not even matching this, cannot match this.
I wanted to bring you in, Ivan. You wrote the piece. Of course, you write about architecture all over the place. Your beat largely is Italy for us. But would you say there's a very specific vernacular up here?
Yes, definitely. And Hans has been quite brilliant in taking these traditional Engadine farmhouses that have these great spaces, which were that they were working farms at one point in the Middle Ages. They were where livestock was on the ground floor, and the people were living there as well upstairs. And he's done great work in remodeling them while preserving the historic elements.
I just wanted to pick up on that as well, because oftentimes what we see is people just keep the facades and then they do something completely almost disrespectful on the inside. I mean, yet you're a modern architect. We're in the 21st century. So how do you balance this notion of preservation, but at the same time, you know, wanting to still push your own style and vernacular?
Yeah. You see, first of all, I have great respect of these buildings. Some of these buildings are 700 years old. They are medieval buildings and they have been growing over the time. Almost all the buildings, they have like a medieval tower inside the house. And there was this big fire in 1499. People didn't want that the enemy takes over, and they put fire on their houses. So before this fire, Zwots, the community of Zwots, looked like San Gimignano. There were about 25 to 30 towers just sticking in the landscape. And in these towers, people have been living. The cattle was outside, the hay was outside. And after 1499, there was this decision to build another type of house. Then the typology of the Engadine farmhouse emerged. Everything happened under the same roof. So these towers are now part of the houses, but also the cattle barn, the hay barn, everything is under the same roof. This is an incredible typology. Beautiful houses, beautiful sequence of spaces.
I wondered, I've been looking around the town today and also looking at some of the amazing old buildings that were demolished, and some of them burnt down, like the Grand Hotel in 1945. I wondered whether you think there have been any real mistakes made in St. Moritz, and whether you think that it has changed its attitude to its heritage, and you're obviously part of that. Do you look back and sort of wince at some of the decisions that were made?
You see, St. Moritz is another story. There are the villages outside, there is St. Moritz. St. Moritz is a city. When I came up here, 74, I was probably the first one who said St. Moritz is a city. People didn't like that at all. They said St. Moritz has to be a village. But St. Moritz was under a great pressure in the 60s, 70s. A lot of apartments have been built, also for natives. The high-rise buildings in the Bad, they're all for natives. But this was just a city transplant architecture coming in. So this city emerged. And people felt this, and they didn't want to have it anymore. So what they did, they said, from now on, from the 70s on, every building, even if it has seven stories, has to look like an Engadin farmhouse. They just blew this image up, filled it with offices and everything. But one can doubt which is worse. I mean, city transplant or, I say, rural imitative architecture.
Ivan, take us inside the work of Mr. Ruch. Tell us about the property that you covered for Alpino for us.
Yeah, I did a piece on a farmhouse in the village of Eschamps, just a bit down the road here. And it was interesting, these houses, these farmhouses, they have these big haylofts, and Hans has mentioned that they're like cathedrals. I mean, they compete with the Gothic churches here in this area. They're, in some cases, he was saying they're four or five stories high, if I'm correct. And what he did was he inserted a sort of a shell inside this farmhouse, and in the hayloft area, it became a great living space with a fireplace. And also, in terms of working with the wood, a lot of the original wood, it used to have livestock trudging through it, and they did a very elaborate process of cleaning out all this to sort of remove the grime of centuries of farming. And then also, he's a great expert on wood, the wood practices here, the carpentry, which is, of course, everyone knows in Switzerland they are masters at this, and also cutting the wood in the winter time. With the special thing of following the lunar cycle. Maybe you should, Hans, maybe just talk about this, the special technique they use here in the valley.
Well, it's not a technique. It's just cutting the wood in the right moon phase. And this actually, for centuries, happened all over the world, also in other cultures. The wood has to be taken out on wintertime. When I examine the old houses, before I intervene as an architect, I always do dendrochronological surveys. We are drilling in the wooden parts. We take out the sequence of earrings, and according to the growth of these earrings, we can exactly see when the wood was taken out of the forest. And even if it was taken out in wintertime or in summertime, and I tell you, 99% of all the wood was taken out of the forest in wintertime, because people knew wood taken out in wintertime is dry, and the movement, the shrinking and the bending is much less than when you take it out in summertime.
That's got to be a great thing. If you're a homeowner now, you have a vacation home, you can tell your guests the whole history of the building, because Hans has prepared a very detailed report. I mean, it's like an anthropology. Going back and looking at these buildings, it's quite remarkable.
Now, I don't want Hans to throw a punch across the table, but for people who are listening who haven't seen his work, if you had to tell listeners who are in Australia or America or elsewhere, going to be careful here, from a stylistic and design perspective, can you draw contemporary parallels? You're sitting closer to him, so it's fine.
Japan.
In terms of, he's come out with a very well-known book about these historic farmhouses. He also does other work doing hotels and other buildings. I think in terms of his intervention, it's very less is more. I mean, in these farmhouses, of course, there is modern elements being put in. I mean, there are these sort of white cubes. I mean, this hayloft, the story I did about this farmhouse in the village of Eschamps, it's a sort of a white sort of gallery space, but the flooring is all, you know, they put in new flooring again from the local area. He works with local carpenters, working with building with the local larch, and of course restoring all the stone pine, the beautiful stone pine that's from the area. As everyone knows, the stone pine is something that helps lower your heart rate. It's one of these great sort of features of the area, using the local building materials. So in terms of sort of his style, I let him sort of take that question and describe. San, what is your style? Is that?
Well, style. See, I just use this local material. I tend to use not many materials. I concentrate on maybe taking wood and stone, and then that's it. And point of view wood, I told you, I can tell the owners of the houses where the tree has been in the forest. So I think that's a big, big quality. These small cycles, we take the material very near the houses, and then they are built into the houses. People have done this 700 years ago in the same way. Why should I take wood from Siberia to use it in the Engadin?
Yeah, that's an architectural message which should be spread. Hans Jorgruch and our correspondent from Milan, Ivan Carvalho, thank you very much for coming up here. Coming up in the next half hour here on Midori House, we're going to be talking further about art in the Engadin, and also our Copenhagen correspondent, keeping it seasonal and Christmassy, Michael Booth, heads up to Finland to meet Santa. But now time to cross back to London to Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. India has today experienced another spate of anti-rape rallies in various parts of the country. The protesters voiced their anger at both the federal and state administration for not initiating remedial measures after the recent brutal gang rape of a 23-year-old paramedical student in the capital, New Delhi. France has said today that it would only protect French nationals in the Central African Republic after the President François Bozizé appealed to Paris and Washington for help to push back rebels. Rebels said they had temporarily halted their advance 45 miles from Bangui to allow talks to take place. The Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, has today criticised Republicans in Congress for refusing to go along with any tax increases as part of the US fiscal cliff remedy. He urged House of Representatives Speaker John Boehner, the top Republican in Congress, to pass a Democrat-backed bill extending low-income tax rates for all Americans except those with a net household income above $250,000 a year. And staying there, heavy snow and high winds have caused traffic jams in the northern part of the United States, bringing chaos to motorways in many states. Highways have been closed and accidents have occurred, including a collision involving six vehicles in Indiana. That's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. This is Midori House on Monocle 24, live from St Moritz.
Now, you almost got lost in the architecture there of Mr. Roof, didn't you?
I did. I found him so absorbing. I mean, he really I love his idea of intervention. He really sort of cherishes that notion of not sort of going in with his vision, his architectural ego and wrecking stuff. He's absolutely nuanced in every way.
And it's great if you pick up a copy, if you've seen a copy of Monocle Alpino already. It's also great the contrast between his work and then the piece that Fiona Wilson did on that really amazing Japanese alpine house up in Nagano, which is absolutely stunning.
It was amazing. Now, when we think of centres for contemporary art, we think of cities like New York, London, Milan and Paris. But perhaps it's time for us to look further afield and up.
Over the past few years, a tiny village in the Swiss mountains has been attracting elite collectors in contemporary art as a cluster of new galleries have set up shop. Forget Frieze and Art Basel. It's time to put on your snow boots and head to Zoetz in the Engadine Valley. Our Gillian Tobias sat down with gallery owner Monica de Cardenas the day after the Alpine Vernissage.
Well, I opened my first gallery in Milano in at the beginning of the 90s, like in 92, 93. But I have always been coming here to the mountains since a child. I learned skiing here, and then I also went to high school here, actually. And then I've always come here for holiday also with my husband. And with the time, I kind of realized that people were asking so many questions about my gallery in Milano. And I kind of realized that there was an interest for art and for contemporary art here. This is one thing. And then the other is that I love these old Engadine houses. And so I kind of put these two things together and managed to buy an old house in the Engadine and renovated it with this very good architect, Hans-Jörg Ruch, who actually invented a new way of restoring these old houses by renovating everything that is old, actually going back to the old structure of the house. But what is new is also clearly modern and contemporary. So there is also a contemporary dimension to the old house. And actually what's great is the tension between old and new.
We're in this amazing space with very beautiful raw wood and striking walls. It is a very good setting for contemporary art, surrounded by the whiteness of snow. Mm-hmm. Do you find it conducive to pieces of art that you're showcasing?
Yes, absolutely. And also the artists love it. And I think it's a particularly good space because it's a historical space. You know, it has a very special character. And I think that today, nowadays, too often we tend to see art just in art fairs, in kind of on dull spaces, on just temporary walls. While I think that art always creates a relationship with the space it is in it, and if the space has a character, there is a fascinating dialogue going on, which adds a lot also to the art and to our perception of the art, I think.
The Engadine Valley, it has a tradition of travelers. Can you talk a little bit about the area and what makes it so special and why people keep coming back?
Well, for one thing, it is, I think, one of the most beautiful places on Earth. I mean, that this valley is so high up in the mountains, but at the same time so wide with these lakes and so much space and air. And I think it's just an amazing beauty, scenic beauty. But at the same time, there's also these old villages with a very specific architectural style that also makes it special. And then later, there is to say, I mean, there has always been also intellectuals coming here. I mean, Nietzsche lived here in the area for 2 years, and Alberto Giacometti comes from here. Segantini lived in the valley, so it's like a place that, even though it's in the mountains, it has a strong cultural tradition, and this makes it more fascinating, of course.
What kind of artists do you think will do well in the Engadine?
Basically, I mean, it's artists that I have been representing for many years, and I just give them this new possibility to show here and to meet an also much more international public. Because here, yes, there's even though it's small, but it's very international. This is the other thing which is fascinating, you know? And that people have time, they're on holiday, so they take much more time to look at the art, to come quietly and to look at what the show, but also what we do the rest of the years. And this is fantastic for us, I think. This is a difference to the city.
What artist did you choose to open the season?
This year I chose Marisa Merz, who's a very important artist who's already in her 80s. And she was the wife of Mario Merz, but a very strong artist in her own right. Actually, the only woman in the Arte Povera movement who really was part of the Arte Povera movement from the very first hour in the 60s. She was in the first shows and she had a very strong character of her own. Of course, like it often happens with women, she's been a bit of in the shadow of her husband, Mario Merz. But at the same time, she's been recognized and admired by very important curators like Harald Seemann. She's been invited to the Biennale of Venice several times. She's done Documenta 2 times. She's had some very important... Her works are in MoMA in New York. And she's an Italian artist I always loved. But of course, in Italy, she's already very well represented, but she's not at all in Switzerland. So this was also a chance for me to show her and to bring her here to this new audience.
It was lovely last night looking at the art, but also looking at the people. We could have been in Milano, but they had their furs and they had their snow boots. Who are your customers? Who are the buyers here?
Well, many important people from Milano have holiday houses here. So from Prada to Beatrice Trussardi to Etro was here last night, to Consuelo Marni. I mean, these are, of course, the well-known people. Then there's others, but it's Italians, but it's also many people come here from Zurich and from southern Germany, from Munich. I mean, this opening last night was very much an Italian opening because it's the Italian weekend. But then, of course, during the Christmas season, there's many more also visitors and also clients that come from Zurich or come from Basel or come from Munich or from London, like Norman Foster or people who come in from further away.
Just up the road we have Samaritz, which attracts the glitz and the glamour. But here you have more and more galleries open up. Can you explain a little bit the gallery scene here and the nature of the art scene that's emerging?
there is like more space and more culture in these villages here, like Zuoz and Schanf and La Punt, because actually Zuoz was the ancient main village of the valley. That Zuoz is here since the Middle Ages, and that's why there's all these beautiful houses that are from the Middle Ages, but also from Renaissance and Baroque, and there's all, you can go through history looking at the village. While Samoritz is a much more recent, it was founded at the around at the turn of the century by the with the first ports and the first big hotels, which is of course also fascinating. But there everything is much more already, there's all these shops, there's all these holiday apartments, while here there's these old houses that give this possibility to make spaces that are much more special and much more beautiful and open still, where you can still develop things.
It seems the art scene here is very international, but is this a good moment in time for contemporary Swiss art?
I think so, yes. There's very good artists in Switzerland. I mean, considering that it's a small country, there's very good art schools, and there is, I mean, in Switzerland in general, there's so many Kunsthallen and institutions, and the young artists are supported very well, and so it's certainly also a good moment for Swiss art, yes.
Monica de Cardenas, ending that report there by Gillian de Baez.
You are listening to Midori House. We're coming to you live from Samoritz. We're on the terrace of the Hauser Hotel. It's just 3:40 if you're listening up in snowy Nisiko right now. It is now it's turned 1941 here in Switzerland. It's 10:41. If you're listening in Ventura, California, of all places, we're going away for a short break. We're back after this.
During snowy December, Midori House is brought to you by Montclair. And from December the 27th to January the 2nd, we'll be heading off-piste to broadcast the briefing in Midori House live from St. Moritz. Montclair, keeping the slopes stylish and warm since 1952.
You are listening to Monocle 24. It is 1941 here in St. Moritz, and we bring you this very special edition of Midori House. Throughout these shows, we are determined to bring you the stories from around the world that can happily reflect the alpine landscape in which we host. Earlier today, we went east to Japan to meet ice harvesters in Niseko. And on this show before, we met hotelier Sepnem Yuhur to find out about the growing trade of winter tourism in Turkey's mountains.
Well, it's the turn of Monocle's Michael Booth, normally in Copenhagen. Michael ventured northward with his son to the once frosty landscapes of Finnish Lapland for Monocle 24 to meet a very special interviewee. Arriving off-season, where snow and ice normally stand, the land was verdant and the climate temperate. Surely Santa Claus would be taking some time off, but this is not a job that you can just leave when the sun comes out, as Michael Booth and son found out.
I've always had a kind of perverse attraction to holiday resorts out of season, whether it's my hometown of Brighton in winter or Mykonos in March, where Monocle sent me on my first assignment in 2007. So I jump at the chance to travel to the self-proclaimed home of Father Christmas, the capital of Lapland, Rovaniemi, on the edge of the Finnish Arctic Circle, in July. I'm going there with my 10-year-old son, Asker, and we are assuming there's no tourists, there's not going to be any Santa, no elves. Well, we're assuming wrong.
My name is Sanna Kortelainen and I work as the managing director of Rovaniemi Local Tourist Board.
And Sanna, where are you taking us to now?
I'm taking you to Arctic Circle, to Santa Claus Village.
So we've actually left Rovaniemi behind, which is the capital of Lapland, and we're heading up towards the Arctic Circle, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's around 10 minutes driving distance north of Rovaniemi city centre.
So people come here, even the height of summer, even if they're not mentally unbalanced like me and my son here, Asker, ordinary people come up here during the summertime to meet Father Christmas.
Yeah, surprisingly many people come over to see to Santa Claus and of course to cross the Arctic Circle and see the nature in summertime.
Sanna introduces me to Marko Jaska, whose family has run the main gift shop at Santa Claus Village for over 20 years. We meet in the gift shop itself, which remarkably is full of tourists filling their baskets with T-shirts and trinkets, reindeer skins and postcards.
Actually, that's a wrong idea that it's summer is low season. It's as long as I remember, it has been the peak season. But if you compare the Christmas season, it's summer season is 1 month longer, so it's not so rush as Christmas season.
So would you be employing the same number of people in July as you do in Christmas?
Yes, we do. Yes, like students, we have extra students working probably 10 to 15 in Christmas season and summer season too, because long days. Yeah.
And how do the visitors differ between Christmas and summer?
I'm sorry, how
what nationalities come in?
Nationalities? Well, not so much big difference. I think mostly from Europe, but of course from all over the world. Only that in Christmas season there is quite a lot British too, and summer season not at all.
After talking to Marco, to fill the time in before our appointment with the man himself, we take a walk around the rest of Santa Claus Village, which seems mainly made up of other shopping opportunities. So we're going to climb the stairs to Father Christmas' house. It is a little bit spooky, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, how old is this guy?
About 2,000 years.
2,000 years old, Have you thought about what you're going to ask him for?
Yeah.
Okay. Don't tell me, keep it a secret. Oh, here's a wall of pictures of various celebrities sitting with Father Christmas. That's your foreign minister, right?
Oh, yeah, that is Alexander Stubb.
And up there we've got John Cleese and Conan O'Brien.
Yes, I'm the president of Finland, the former president.
And is that Lordi? The Eurovision, Finnish Eurovision winners?
Yeah, that is definitely the most famous Rovaniemi rock band in the world.
Oh, they're actually from Rovaniemi?
Yes, they are local.
Okay.
Local monsters.
There's videos playing of reindeers in the snow to get us in the mood. And here we have a row of high-backed chairs. The final waiting place to go in and meet the man himself.
Hello there.
Oh, we have an elf. Thank you very much. And there he is.
Hello.
Father Christmas, or do you prefer Santa Claus?
Oh, whatever. Or joulupukkias, we say in Finland.
Joulupukkias.
Yeah, joulupukki.
It's very nice to meet you. Thank you so much for finding time.
My pleasure.
We're from Monocle 24. I don't know if you know Monocle.
Of course I know Monocle. I think Monocle 24 is known all around the world. Actually, I was looking, is that a Monocle notebook? Because they have some nice notebooks, but that's not one of them.
I'd rather you didn't point that out. It's a normal shop-bought one. And you've caught me out there. But we're fascinated by what Rovaniemi is like in the summertime here. What do you do all day in the summer?
Oh, all sorts of things, of course. Things with the reindeer, things with the elves. I've been in Korvatunturi, where my secret workshops are. And we're quite busy here. And actually, the funny thing is, that in summer, we are always international, but in summer, the Rovaniemi is especially international. We actually, one day here, counted within one day 48 different nationalities. And it actually took me a while to figure out why this is so, but then, of course, it's quite clear. In summer, you can travel here in any way or form of transport. People come walking, bicycle, scooter, private car, mobile home, caravans, buses, all possible ways. Whereas in winter, you can come by train or you can come by plane. And if you have winter tires and spikes and things, then you can also...
Or reindeer, of course.
Of reindeer, of course, and snowmobile and all that.
I mean, it did occur to me that, and I'm not in a position to tell Father Christmas how to do his job, but you only seem to work for one day a year. Have you ever thought about getting the management consultants in to kind of spread that out over the year and figure out how you could do things differently?
Now, Michael, that's an interesting point, actually, that is. Yeah.
Could you maybe manage your time a bit better so it wasn't all so stressed on that one day of the year?
I don't think so, really, because it really doesn't change anything. You have to get the presents out there. But it's funny you should say, work one day. If I compare, it might be like if I take your work, Michael, you go around days, weeks, sometimes months, I'm sure. You make a report, you collect information, then you edit it down, and then it comes out, and it's maybe a 15 minutes or half an hour document. So people say, easy life, Michael, only 15 minutes today he's worked. So in my work is like that. Most of the things I do and the elves do, it doesn't show until, of course, then Christmas Eve and Christmas Day, when the presents are already unpacked and they are given out and so.
So it is an all year round job, really?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
I've racked my brains to think up of a question that you've never been asked before, that Santa Claus has never been asked. And I have it for you now. Santa Claus, what would you like for Christmas?
What I want is not very... You can't wrap it up. It's not... It's quite wide, I might say. It's for the children, you know. I wish that all the children in the world would have all the things they have right to have, they're entitled to have. Healthcare, education, the possibility to learn, to read and to write, and these sorts of things. When these are sorted out, then I'm happy.
That's very, very noble, so that makes me even more ashamed to say that. Is it wrong that I wish for a Maserati Quattroporte?
Which colour?
Kind of light bronze with a tan interior, please. Mm. It doesn't have to be new.
Mm-hmm. I look into it.
Oh, bless you, Father Christmas. Thank you so much, and thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. My son here is Asker. He's 10. Asker, you had a question for Father Christmas. What's your question?
My question is, do you give presents to kids around the whole world?
Different religions?
Yeah, different religions and all that stuff.
Yeah, I do. Asker, it's like this. For me... with the people and with the children, the background, the cultural, the color, the religion and the language, they don't have any meaning at all. I love and respect people, you know, all across, all over, and it's, for me, it's just the same.
Well, I'll leave you two alone now, because Asker has a few things he needs to discuss with you.
Fine,
so
fine.
Santa Claus, thank you so much
thank
for your
you very
time
much. Michael, can I take this opportunity? And I want to send my best wishes and love to all the listeners of Monocle 24. Take care, be good. Christmas is coming.
And that was Santa. Santa couldn't be any smoother, could he?
No, he's wonderful. He does actually just conjure the real Santa. He speaks so many different languages.
I know, and it was incredible, because Michael went up there this summer. It was a bit of a scoop to get this interview, but it was a real scoop to have Santa after his Japan tour. He was a little bit jet lagged, and then he was there at our Christmas market in London for two full days, like a complete trooper.
I was also his assistant for several hours.
You were.
I got to know him, and I have to say, I think he's probably the real Santa.
Yeah, he's the real deal, absolutely. I mean, he's pretty clear about how his business plan functions and all of those things, but it was great to have that piece of him. You are listening to Midori House. We are live in Samaritz. When we come back in a moment, we have a little special piece from our editor, Andrew Tuck. Stay with us. And now for a very homemade comment from our editor, Andrew Tuck, who will join us in a few days, but remains in audio spirit for now at least. He reveals why, as a child, his mother's knitting efforts could leave him looking like a midget fisherman and his Action Man sporting some surprisingly fashion-forward outfits.
But nothing beats the winter pleasure of making a pom-pom for his bubble hat.
Hand-knitted. Those two words, stitched together, are supposed to give you an inner glow to match the outer one provided by the chunky wool. Amazing! Some humble granny knitted the sweater that now boasts a price tag that would keep the said crafty old dear fed and quenched like a queen for the rest of her life. Hand-knitted, you see, has become a mark of exclusivity and a symbol of uniqueness. No two jumpers are ever the same. I get it, but for me, hand-knitted means homemade. And I'm not sure that as a child I was always that appreciative of the wonders of outfits created one loop at a time by my mother. When you were heading off to school in an Aran jumper, looking like a midget fisherman who'd lost his way, you sometimes yearned for knitwear that sported a guaranteed factory-made label. Thinking back, there was hardly ever a night as a kid when I didn't hear the clicking of needles and find myself watching out of the corner of my eye as something elaborate and fluffy grew row by row. There were the matching fisherman knits for me and my dad, miniature jumpers for a growing brood of nephews and nieces, and if you pestered enough, you could have really tiny jumpers for various teddy bears and even Action Man. In my house, in the late 1960s, Action Man had ditched his army fatigues, eschewed the rubber diving outfit with its impossible-to-fit flippers, and settled instead for a white crewneck jumper. Being rather fashion-forward, he even had knitted shorts. The days of sleeping in the jungle and worrying about snipers in the garden were over for him. His dreams were now of catwalks and Paris, thanks to the nimble fingers of my mother. Most years, as the days shortened and the frost arrived, a hat would be produced. Something slightly scratchy and probably made from wool left over from a previous project. The best part of this millinery moment was that I had a job to do. Make the pom-pom, or bobble, that would be attached to the top as a finishing flourish. Now, anyone who's ever been given this task will know it's a simple but unbelievably rewarding job. From the cutting of the card circles, you may need a parent for this bit, to the threading of the wool, it's all creative joy. Then there's the final splicing and trimming. Just saying this makes me want to find the wool bag. One year, the bobble was all white, which led, for a five-year-old, to a terrifying incident. While I was feeding the ducks on the Thames, a vast swan approached along the towpath from behind and mistook the white bobble for a piece of bread. In one jab, it removed the hat, jumped back into the river, and sailed away. I will never forget his mean eye. I believe there were tears. Mine, not the swan's. Rest assured, the bobble was a swan-safe green or navy in subsequent years. For Monocle, I'm Andrew Tuck.
And Andrew will be here in Samarit in the coming days. It sounds like he won't be wearing a bubble hat.
No, I'm very excited about his headgear. I think we might get him in a bit of a fur headband like you're sporting this evening.
I know, this is mink. But it's doing a good job. It's actually sort of somehow compatible with our headphones and all the radio apparatus.
Well, I had completely figured out my outfit, totally, and then I didn't factor in the headphones because I thought I was going to be wearing also a nice sheared beaver hat that I have it on. But it will come out at some later point this week. We're going away for a very short break. We're back with a few parting words. It is almost time to say goodbye. We thought we were going to have a few songs this evening, but we didn't get there.
We didn't. Too chatting.
I know. You were pushing for a song, but we never managed to sort of crank. But maybe tomorrow we'll get a chance to do that. Today's show was produced by Alad John. Our researcher was Manon Spindler. And our studio manager is Jack Phillips, really manning the deck, doing an absolutely outstanding job without gloves, which, I don't know, it must be sort of his Essex roots or something like that, but he's managed to man the deck like that.
Steely.
Very valiant. Also, Isabel Kayser has been our production coordinator. She's somewhere up in Appenzell. We're hoping that she'll be joining us as well. News is coming up in about 30 seconds time back, 1 minute and 30 seconds time back in London. Also, we'll have this week's episode of The Herbist, indeed, with our Andrew. They're getting incredibly rowdy here on the terrace.
I know,
we've
had some wonderful glühweins from the Hauser staff, and now I think the party troupe is coming in.
Yeah, no, big thanks to Mr. Marcus Hauser, who's been looking after us in stellar form. Tomorrow we've got Thomas Floor of VistaJet is going to be here, also be talking to the CEO of Victorinox. But for me, Tyler Berlates, goodbye.
And me, Sophie Grove, it's goodbye.
See you tomorrow.